I guess maybe I have a question for you. I mean, there's something that I'm curious about, which seems to be a sort of like historical or sort of practical or circumstantial split between the like type theory community and the kind of set theory logic community.
Hello. I'm very happy today to have Emily Riehl with us. She is a professor for mathematics at the Johns Hopkins University, and I've met her several times and always enjoy talking to her or listening to her talks. She's an expert in, I would say, higher category theory, right? Is that fair to say, or how would you describe yourself, Emily?
Sure. Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah.
Okay. So I just looked up, apparently it was Steenrod who said category theory is abstract nonsense. So are you doing higher abstract nonsense, or?
Sure. Increasingly abstract nonsense, perhaps. I love that quote of Steenrod, and I think he meant it positively. So, you know, sometimes yes. People, you know, abstract nonsense is kind of like queer in that different people mm-hmm. mean different mm-hmm. things in using that, but mm-hmm. it's been embraced by the category theory community for a certain style of proof that those of us who are working in category theory really like. It's what drew me to the field. So.
But you didn't get stuck there with category theory. You went for the full Monty, for higher stuff, right?
I first became interested in category theory in a year I spent at Cambridge. I took a course by Peter Johnstone, an 8-week-ish, maybe 10-week, I forget how long the terms are there, course in category theory that covered quite a lot of material in a short amount of time. I sort of mm-hmm. took the year to kind of fully absorb the course. And then starting that summer, I attended my first international category theory conference, which really gave me a sense of the research frontiers of the field. And I found myself drawn to talks that involved abstract homotopy theory in some way. So some categorical abstractions, you know, such as due to Quillen, that allows you to kind of mimic constructions from homotopy theory in more general categories. And now that is understood as being some sort of presentation of a higher dimensional structure on the category. So I guess that's how I got into higher category theory.
No. Maybe can you say a few words about homotopy theory and what it is and why it matters?
Sure. Right. So, you know, there's this fundamental mathematical question, maybe philosophical question of when is one thing the same as another thing? And there's different ways that you can answer it. There's sort of the answer embedded in first order logic. This is Leibniz's indiscernibility of identicals or identity of indiscernibles. So, you know, two things are the same if and only if they have exactly the same properties. But that's not really how mathematicians use this notion of being the same. You know, mathematicians tend to be very metaphorical. So to a category theorist, if you have two objects that belong to the same category and they somehow have the same shape. The technical term is isomorphic. The etymology is roughly that sort of same shape, meaning from the point of view of all the other objects in the category, they look the same, then they're the same, even though they're not literally equal. They might be isomorphic. So there are examples, you know, in the group theory, you'll learn about different presentations of groups that end up having exactly the same structure. And even though the presentations are different, the groups are isomorphic, and a group theorist would consider them the same. In linear algebra, any 10-dimensional vector space is considered the same as any other 10-dimensional vector space. So depending on choice of basis, you know, you might need explicit isomorphisms to identify them. So that's sort of one perspective of what sameness means. But that's often not even flexible enough.
Because it rings a bell, what you just said. So you think the Leibniz principle suggests a more intentional equality, so to say. But as you know, I'm coming from type theory.
Sure.
I'm a big fan of this Leibniz principle because how do you actually describe the difference of two things which you call isomorphic? You have to observe the internal structure, and in my world, you're not even permitted to do this, right? So this principle of equality of indiscernibles is actually valid in tag theory in HOT, right?
Yes. So right, you interrupted my sort of attempt to give a more classical account of what homotopy theory is, and I didn't mean. maybe we'll return to that, and then we can come back to new perspectives on Leibniz's indiscernibility of identicals in homotopy type theory, for instance. But anyway, all I was going to say is, there are mathematical objects that mathematicians working in the area would consider to be the same, even though they are not isomorphic. Example everybody likes to mention is, to a topologist of a certain bent, a coffee cup and a donut are the same. I don't think that's a great example because those spaces are actually homeomorphic, which is to say isomorphic in the category of spaces. But an example I like better is a, pair of pants and a thong. These spaces are homotopy equivalent. And if you're interested in, sort of counting how many holes there are in the space or how many higher dimensional holes there are in the space, the answers would be the same, even though the thong sort of is one dimensional in some sense and the pair of pants is two dimensional in sort of some sense. And so what homotopy theory is about is it's a language that allows you to treat objects that are not isomorphic but are equivalent or perhaps weakly equivalent as nevertheless being the same. But anyway, what Torsten was referring to just now is, you probably have a better sense of this history than I do, frankly, but, maybe I'll describe it as some sort of new perspectives on the indiscernibility of identicals. So the way I was, what I was imagining when I mentioned it earlier is it's, this is the way equality is axiomatized in first order logic.
Yes,
and so I was thinking
mm-hmm.
of the notion of equality that is kind of familiar in set theory, where two sets are equal sort of if and only if they have exactly the same elements. And, if the elements have slightly different names but are sort of in one-to-one correspondence, that's not what equal means in set theory.
Uh-huh.
But as you well know, this is very far from how equal gets used in a mathematics paper. If you read a mathematician's paper, they'll often write equals when they really mean isomorphic or maybe uh-huh. even something weaker than that. And there are other approaches to foundations, using Martin Luf identity types, but maybe without equality reflection, so intentionally rather than extensionally, that are compatible with indiscernibility of identicals and more flexible, allow sort of a more metaphorical meaning of equality.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you obviously you come from a sort of classical mathematical background, and you only learned about this sort of exotic stuff like type theory later. So,
and I might qualify that even more strongly. So the mathematics curriculum in the United States, which is where I'm from, is a bit different, I'd say, than elsewhere in the world. Part of that is an artifact of our liberal arts system. So as an undergraduate, I was a mathematics concentrator, meaning I took more mathematics courses than courses in any other topic. But of the 32-ish courses I took as an undergrad, that meant 12 of them were math courses. And I spent the rest of the time taking, music theory and queer theory and American intellectual history and modern British novel and various other things. So in this sort of condensed undergraduate mathematics curriculum, there often isn't much time for logic. And in particular, I didn't study logic and foundations as an undergraduate. I did not study it as a graduate student. When I earned my PhD, I almost certainly could not have told you the axioms of set theory, Zermelo-Frankel set theory.
Not many people can.
As a postdoc, I taught the undergraduate logic course, which was offered in the department. I just didn't end up taking it. And I learned a lot then about sort of classical approaches to foundations. And then sort of around the same time, I was getting exposure to an interest in homotopy type theory. And that's how I got into other perspectives.
So maybe I know some part of the audience will hate me for that, but for me, that was quite quick already. And we mixed already quite a lot of disciplines. And I'm not a category theorist at all. So I come from set theory. Is it okay if I ask, would it be fine for you to give like a very rough idea of category theory for that part of the audience that's not there? And maybe if there is something like your own perspective in particular, because you have a lovely introductory book, Category Theory in Context, right? Which I guess many people take as like a good first step into this realm.
Great. Yes, I'd love to describe category theory. So I think a big innovation that sort of separated 20th century mathematics from 19th century mathematics was the idea that if you're interested in a particular sort of mathematical object, like a group, you might productively study it by considering also the homomorphisms between groups. So this is an insight that I associate with Emmy Noether, among others. And so even if you're just interested in studying properties of individual groups, somehow treating them as a collective and looking at the way the sort of relationships between one group and another, which are depicted using arrows with a domain being one group and a codomain being another group. And these are sort of structure-preserving functions called homomorphisms. That was sort of an important insight and led to new breakthroughs in group theory. And simultaneously, a similar perspective was being applied in other disciplines. So, you know, topologists were interested in distinguishing one space for the other, maybe by means of some sort of numerical invariant or polynomial invariant. And around the same time, it was discovered that if your invariant somehow respected continuous functions between spaces, then it meant it was a lot easier to compute and had more powerful information. So a way to describe what these discoveries are doing simultaneously is they're moving from studying individual objects of a particular type, so groups or topological spaces, to studying the category of groups or the category of topological spaces. So a category has both objects, but also arrows, sometimes called morphisms, sometimes called homomorphisms between them that satisfy a few certain axioms and unlock the possibility of a completely new style of definition. So you can characterize constructions on the objects in terms of their effect on the morphisms, for instance. In fact, you can identify everything you ever want to know about an object in a category in terms of the morphisms to other objects as a consequence of something called the innate lemma. And so that's sort of the insights that launched category theory. And then another thing that it can do is it can help unify different mathematical disciplines. So there are some facts that are true of groups and true of spaces and true of vector spaces and true of other things for exactly the same reason. And it's because you can abstract them to the level of a generic category and generic objects and in a generic relationship and prove the theorem at that level of generality. So these are the proofs by abstract nonsense that we were alluding to earlier. And its effect is that it'll isolate the aspects of any particular mathematical discipline that are sort of formal or that are true for very general reasons. Or it can be understood via analogy to a completely other discipline from the aspects that are particular to that discipline. So, anyway.
Just a little note, as you know, this is, category theory also became increasingly popular in computer science via functional programming, where people usually use Haskell. They see like monads and functors and whatever. So that's a different point of access. But it shows already, as you said, that it's quite sort of universal.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, category theory, among other things, is a language that allows you to very efficiently express some rather complicated constructions. And it makes it easier to define and study, you know, new kinds of mathematical objects that weren't considered or weren't so easy to think about before. So the, you know, sort of the fundamental objects that one studies these days in algebraic geometry are defined using categorical language, same in modern homotopy theory. In computer science, there are some categories that are you don't sort of stumble across in nature, but you can build. I'm thinking maybe specifically the Kleisley construction associated to a monad that, you know, handle computational effects in a very elegant way. So
it's actually a way to structure programs in the use of computer of category theory is often just a way to modularized programs, right? And is it quite a bit maybe different, or is there a similarity with mathematics, you would say? Is category theory useful to structure? I think it is, isn't it?
I guess I would say so. And I mean, I'm thinking, Grothendieck's work in algebraic geometry in the mid-20th century, you know, he ended up creating a whole bunch of category theory in pursuit of, you know, introducing new sort of structures, new techniques in algebraic geometry. So absolutely.
May I follow up with another naive question? And I mean, now you sketched beautifully this idea of the bird's eye perspective of, and now what makes, like, is it possible to talk about all kinds of structures, or is there even, like, in category theory at some point, you need, like, more complex categories? And if I'm not mistaken, this is also part of this higher category theory or infinite categories. Is there a way to understand that as an outsider, or is that only accessible after some category theory?
Yeah, so I mean, there are certainly limitations to category theory. So one of them is they deal with the general aspects of any particular mathematical subdiscipline, not the particular ones. So, and there's an area called representation theory, which is considering sort of groups in terms of their actions on a vector space. And some, you know, maybe about half of representation theory is very formal. If you have a subgroup, you can construct something called an induced representation. And this is an instance of a very general category theoretic construction. And so the properties of induced representations can be proven formally, sort of much more abstractly. But then there are other aspects of representation theory that are more particular to the subject. So, you know, the particular irreducible representations of a particular family of groups, can't always be understood using category theory. So that's one sort of limitation. Category theory is really a collection of proof techniques, and those techniques apply to some kinds of problems and not to other kinds of problems. But another sort of limitation, which is leading us towards higher category theory, is some kinds of mathematical objects really live in a more complicated mathematical setting. And so the first examples are either something like a topological space or a chain complex. So for topological spaces, kind of the default notion of homomorphism between them is a continuous function. So this is a function between the underlying sets of points that somehow respects the topology. That's kind of not the end of the story. So you might imagine two different topological spaces. One of them is the circle and the other one is the torus, so the sort of surface of a donut. And we could have two different continuous functions from the circle into the surface of the donut. So imagine like tracing out a loop on the surface of the torus. Depending on which specific loops you're imagining tracing on the surface of the torus, they may or may not be homotopic. And homotopic means you could kind of continuously deform one loop onto the other loop without sort of slicing through the donut or, you know, leaving the surface or something like this. And what this homotopy should be understood is it's also a kind of morphism, but it's a higher dimensional morphism that exists between the two continuous functions that we were imagining. And it's giving an extra dimension of information to this situation. And then there's a notion of homotopy between homotopy, which would be a higher dimensional morphism between these higher dimensional morphisms. So we've gone from objects in dimension one to objects in dimension zero to morphisms in dimension one to homotopies in dimension two to higher homotopies in dimension three and four and five and six, and that goes on ad infinitum. If you ignore this higher structure or quotient out by this higher structure, you're losing some information. And so there are certain questions about spaces that really cannot be answered very well or at the level of the ordinary category of spaces and continuous functions, but are better approached in the higher category, the infinity category of spaces, continuous functions, and all of the higher homotopies.
It's interesting that, I mean, that you naturally use a example from homotropy theory, but you're not mentioning something like the category of categories and so on, which from a computer science point of view would be the sort of natural way to look. But
yeah, so that's also another route into higher category theory. So, you know, categories have a notion of morphism between them, which is called functor. But even in the 1940s, the original paper on category theory, it was not about categories, nor was it about functors. It was about the higher dimensional morphisms between functors, which are called natural transformations. And yeah, so category theory is itself a higher dimensional subject.
Mm-hmm. Actually, In sort of traditional category theory, people usually say that the category of categories is just a category. And in the world I live, this is sort of slightly wrong. What's your feeling about this? I mean,
I guess I don't know what you're referring to. So I think of the category of categories most naturally as a two category.
Exactly. That's what I, yeah.
Yeah. Adding in the higher morphisms.
Yeah.
I guess you could say the one category of categories is what's called Cartesian closed. So it has objects inside it, which are functor categories. And inside those functor categories, you have these higher dimensional morphisms. So that's a trick sometimes in which a higher category can be accessed via just a lower categorical structure. So an ordinary one-dimensional category that is Cartesian closed is enriched over itself. And so in these internal HOM objects, you can access some sort of enhanced structure.
I just meant because in a sense, equality of objects is more complicated, or in the hot language is not a proposition. And in this sense, the category of categories isn't just an ordinary category, but as you say, it's a two category. That comes from this theoretic perspectives in your view.
Yeah, I mean, another, you know, so a thing that I've, a practice that I've engaged in more over the past decade is computer formalization. And, you know, whether we're, you know, so, giving definitions about categories and constructions about categories, proving theorems about categories, not just on pen and paper, but interactively with a computer proof assistant. And so the computer proof assistants are often implement a formal system called dependent type theory, not, you know, which is a different approach to foundations. And I'm completely setting aside sort of categories and homotopy type theory. Let's say dependent type theory in the sense that's implemented in the computer proof assistant lean, where identity types are propositions and you have proof of relevance of propositions and so on. But there's an interesting design decision in explaining what a category is in dependent type theory. So a category has sort of two sorts of objects. There's the objects of a category, and then there's the arrows in a category. And so you could define a category to have a type of objects and a type of arrows, and then there are source and target functions between the objects and the arrows, and identity functions and a composition function and some axioms and so on. Or you could define a category to have a type of objects and then a dependent type of arrows. So given, you know, rather than having a type that consists of all of the arrows in the category, having for any pair of objects, a type of arrows from the first object to the second object. You know, somehow that one decision, you know, has huge stakes for the way everything else is formalized thereafter, in a way that I find quite interesting. So I mean, for instance, like a lot of statements that one would write on paper, you know, particularly when we're considering sort of equality between functors or, you know, don't even type check. If you take the second perspective where you're defining the morphisms to be a dependent type. So to prove that one functor is equal to some other functor, you would prove firstly that for all objects in the domain category, these functors act the same way on the objects. And then on paper, I would say, and the same thing for the morphism. So for all morphisms in the domain category, the functors act the same way on the morphisms. But But that statement now will involve an equality between an arrow in one Hom type and an equality between an arrow in a different Hom type. And you have to kind of transport along the proofs of equality between the objects to get those two arrows to belong to the same type. Anyway, I think this is sort of an interesting feature when it comes to formalizing even one mm-hmm. category theory in the proof assistant lean, which adopts this second definition.
Nick, mm-hmm. there raise a question we had on our very first episode of About Logic with Kevin Buzzard. We mm-hmm. had a discussion between Kevin and Thorsten whether you can or should use lean without opening up the foundation, so to speak. And I mean, clearly for some mathematicians, it works fine without opening anything. And for others, maybe not. And could you say, how is it for you? Can you do your most advanced work, so to speak, just on input packages and start doing? Or do you always need to open the packages?
Right. So I have been formalizing some proofs in Lean, but also in other proof assistants. And the reason I'm also working in other proof assistants is because I'm formalizing proofs that just cannot work in Lean right now.
Yes.
And, you know, particularly when it comes to sort of higher dimensional categories, you know, you can give a definition of an infinity category in Lean using something called the quasi-category model. So that definition exists. But it's essentially like taking this notion of an infinite dimensional category and kind of compiling it out to the foundations of mathematics. So, you know, traditionally we think of mathematical objects as built, you know, with a bunch of sets and, you know, functions and structures and axioms and so on and so forth. And the problem is that an infinite dimensional category isn't really built out of sets. You could sort of give it a presentation or give it coordinates and pretend that it's built out of sets. You can build one out of sets, but it's sort of not the most natural approach to the definition. Sort of morally, a infinite dimensional category should be built out of something called homotopy types or anima or infinity groupoids. Sort of these are topological spaces, but really considered only up to homotopy equivalence or weak homotopy equivalence. And in other approaches to foundations, you know, homotopy type theory is described as a sort of synthetic theory of homotopy types. Mm-hmm. When you say you have a type, it automatically has this kind of higher dimensional structure. And, you know, rather than build it in laboriously, it's just there. And you can give a much more efficient definition of what an infinity category is if homotopy type theory is the background language. And, you know, starting from a simpler definition will also simplify formalizations. So I'm part of two collaborative formalization projects attempting to formalize some infinity category theory in two different proof assistants, one of which is Lean and the other of which is something called RESC or RZK. Mm-hmm. And we've gotten a lot further in RESC, even though the proof assistant is much more primitive, just because the foundation system is a lot more amenable to the type of math we're trying to do.
Can you maybe expand this a little bit? So I think this quasi-category approach is sort of what you would call analytic. There's a mm-hmm. concrete definition mm-hmm. of what an infinity category is. But at the same time, it's almost unusable. And I think you mentioned that there was actually, in one of your talks, that there was actually a bug in the definition, which nobody noticed because nobody did anything with it, right?
Yeah, so the notion of quasi-category is definitely usable on paper. And, you know, for students, it's kind of nice because it's relatively concrete. If you're a student who, you know, is very comfortable with ordinary one-dimensional category theory and has maybe already met simplicial sets by taking an algebraic topology course, then you can explain what a quasi-category is. But and it's kind of like giving I do use the term analytics, but it's like explaining infinity categories, but we're choosing coordinates everywhere. And the coordinates sort of don't matter. And you want to make sure that your construction are independent of the choice of coordinates, but nevertheless, they're baked into the definition. So you can, from that notion, you know, state and prove a bunch of theorems. It often involves a lot of technical, what we would call combinatorics, though it's sort of a combinatorics of infinite sets. So a combinatorialist might disagree. But in a proof assistant, it turns out this is just very, very, very difficult. So what Thorsten is alluding to is the fact that the closely related definition of a complex, which is the analytic perspective on infinity groupoids, that was wrong for maybe several years. And it was wrong in a way that if anybody had tried to prove any theorems with it, they would have caught the mistake. But there are essentially no theorems that had been proven about quasi-categories or con-complexes in Lean until very recently. The main success is a master's thesis of Jack McKeown, who successfully proved that if X and Y are quasi-categories, or really Y is the only one that needs to be a quasi-category, then the sort of internal HOM Y to the X is again a quasi-category. This is a sort of very, very fundamental result. You can't do anything in quasi-category theory without that result. But there are a lot of details in that proof. And it took, I think, a year and a half to formalize. It is still being PR'd into MathLib. It really makes you feel despairing of formalizing anything more complicated than that, given how hard it was to do this very fundamental thing. So,
I mean, here's a question. Is this synthetic approach, is this just, I mean, more convenient because you get rid of the spoiler plate, or is it a different conceptual approach to do mathematics?
Right. So one way to think about it is you're putting a convenient kind of abstraction boundary around the notion of a quasi of infinity category, you know, which is a well-known kind of method in engineering. I take it. In the literature, when researchers use infinity categories, they often don't use quasi-categories. They sort of prefer to work model independently. So sort of implicitly in reference to some axioms that maybe haven't quite been written down anywhere of things that ought to be true about infinity categories and have been proven in the quasi-category model somewhere, we hope. And we're just going to argue from those principles rather than explain exactly the effect of these constructions on quasi-categories. That's sort of what's happening already in the pen and paper literature. But I should say that the what's happening in the synthetic approach is kind of more radical than that, in the same way that homotopy type theory, I would say, is a more radical perspective on homotopy theory than just saying we're going to introduce some axioms. In homotopy type theory, you're also sort of changing the kind of meaning of the logical operations. When you say there exists some X and C, so that for all Y and C, X equals Y in the homotopy type theory, what that means is something a bit different. So firstly, this exists is interpreted constructively. So it provides you an explicit choice of a point X and C. The for all Y and C is interpreted in a continuous fashion. So it and the equals X equals Y is interpreted as the choice of a path. So we're saying I'm given an explicit point, which I'll call the center of contraction, so that for all other points Y, I'm continuously choosing a path from X to Y. And what that means is this sort of sentence that in first order logic would assert that the set C has a unique element. In homotopy type theory, it interprets that the type C is a contractible space, so sort of something more powerful. And that's extremely convenient from the perspective of higher category theory, when contractibility is the only meaning of a uniqueness that ever makes any sense. So sort of similarly, these kind of reinterpretations of the logical operations mean that in the synthetic approach to infinity categories, any function from infinity category A to infinity category B that I specify by perhaps explaining what it does on the objects is automatically a functor of infinity categories. And that's something that's very difficult on pen and paper. Like actually defining an explicit functor between explicit infinity categories is something you basically never do, because there'd be an infinite amount of higher dimensional coherence checks. It's kind of completely infeasible. You always use some trick appealing to some kind of universal property or some sort of magic reason why this functor exists. But in ordinary one category, you often do just define functors. You say, for every object in the category A, here's the corresponding object in the category B. And for every morphism in the category A, here's the corresponding morphism in the category B. And you can do something a lot more like that in this synthetic approach to infinity categories, because we've sort of kind of reinterpreted the entire formal system, not just given axioms for infinity categories.
So you emphasized convenience again, but what you described before is that, like, maybe the natural way mathematicians sort of reason is, I mean, as you say, not really in detail analytic. So analytic is just used as a reference, but maybe they use some sort of synthetic, some half-baked synthetic reasoning, and maybe this sort of more developed synthetic mathematics is sort of filling this gap. Does this make sense?
I think the dream for the future, and your account of the development of this is very, very accurate. I think a lot of new mathematics is sort of half-baked for a long time, and you kind of backfill the rigor. You know, so I mean, as I understand it, like, Cantor's work on infinity sort of predated a rigorous axiomatization of set theory, for instance, and, you know, a lot of the work on calculus kind of predated a rigorous understanding of what calculus is, and, you know, that's sort of as it should be, but I think the sort of modern hope is that as you kind of backfill these synthetic systems, they become sort of formal to the point that you could teach the rules to a computer and then build a computer proof assistant that would then allow you to sort of kind of rapidly confirm, I mean, try to prove false and, you know, sort of check the consistency of these axioms, maybe in a empirical way rather than a sort of meta theoretical way. You know, and also just get used to the new synthetic framework. So in my personal experience of learning homotopy type theory, I, you know, first heard a bunch of lectures and then, you know, read pieces of the hot book and then tried to do some exercises in pen and paper. And I wasn't entirely sure that I had everything right. Then I taught a course in homotopy type theory and as a challenge to myself, wrote all the problem sets for this course using EGDA. And so I spent, you know, like a lot of time every week sort of writing and solving these EGDA problem sets that I was developing. And I very quickly caught the kind of little tiny errors that I was making. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was
Did you use cubical EGDA or was it just vanilla EGDA?
No, vanilla EGDA.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah, vanilla EGDA. But, you know, with the feedback of the proof assistant, you know, ever since then, I feel very confident now doing pen and paper homotopy type theory. I know because I have this sort of experience where a bunch of slightly wrong ideas were corrected by the proof assistant.
So I find also it's a good, for me, it's a good way to teach certain things because the students can, as you say, intuitively learn what is the correct way of reasoning without having to see any sort of formal rules. I mean, so the tension is you can give the sort of informal explanation, but they're often informal and unsound. Or you can say, okay, we have a formal system, but who understands the formal system?
Enough.
But then this computer's proof system is sort of a nice middle ground that you can acquire the intuition what is the correct proof by using it. And then maybe you don't actually need it anymore because you have acquired this intuition.
Right. And of course, like, it's also nice to get immediate feedback. I mean, big problem in mathematics pedagogy is students do their homework, and then by the time they get it back a week later, nobody's thinking about the problem anymore. It's much nicer to be corrected immediately. So, yeah.
And last, I mean, that's embarrassing because it's just a computer, not a tutor, right? So, actually, related to this, are you using AI? Have you tried to do proofs using one of the AI implementations, like?
Yes. So currently there are autoformalization agents that are targeting Lean. They're not anything specific targeting other proof assistants that I'm aware of. But I have been experimenting a little bit with AIs targeting Lean in a couple different capacities. So, you know, I've been testing their capabilities with ordinary one category theory, just, you know, initially I was kind of very skeptical that these systems would be able to do much of anything just because, you know, one category theory, it's more about constructing definitions than proving theorems. Mm-hmm. And Lean treats those two activities somewhat differently. And indeed, that does seem to be a limitation for some of the autoformalization agents. more recently, I've been, testing whether these kind of elementary on pen and paper arguments involving simplicial sets and quasi-categories, whether some of the sort of invisible mathematics could be automated away with AI. I've not had a lot of success there yet, no. I would have to say, just because I think there are kind of a lot of technical details. But I should say I much prefer to interact with an auto-formalization agent than a large language model in discussing mathematics, because the large language models will feed you a lot of bullshit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in particular, in the last few weeks, I've been I'm currently in the process of revising my category theory book, and I was trying to develop a few new counterexamples. So if you drop hypothesis X from theorem Y, conclusion Z is false, that sort of thing. And, first thing I should do is do a literature search. Do these counterexamples exist in the literature? And, if something is in the literature, a large language model is pretty good at surfacing it. But if it's not in the literature, it'll sort of blame the literature for the fact that it's not able to come up with the counterexample. And so,
or does it make it up?
Right. So it would say, but this is a well-known mistake in exercise 6.2.V of Real's category theory in context. So then I go to the bookshelf, and indeed, there's no exercise 6.2.V. And so I did not make a mistake. But at some point, I sort of gave that up and, came up with my own counterexample. And then I asked Harmonix, which is one of these AI startups, agent Aristotle, to verify it for me in Lean as a kind of extra check that my counterexample was correct. I did not ask a large language model for this because if they tell me it's correct, I feel like that gives me no assurance, really. But indeed, this is something in one category theory, and Aristotle was able to confirm that it is a valid counterexample. So,
I think this is a nice sort of combination of AI and formal proofs, because if you don't trust AI, as long as the AI can produce a formal proof, then it's trustworthy, right?
Well, so there's some caveats there that, experienced users are well aware of, but I'd like to state for the record. So caveat number one, what the AI is producing is the source text or the user input text for a computer proof assistant, and you're relying on the proof assistant to type check it. And what a proof assistant is doing is it will verify that stated proof, in fact, proves the stated statement. It does not verify that the stated statement is the one that was intended. And in particular, if part of what your auto-formalization agent is doing is providing new definitions, it's quite possible that the statement is wrong. And this could be in a relatively innocuous way. So, for example, for my teaching, I was preparing a demo for my students of a formal proof in Lean that the square root of 2 is irrational. And so I open up my Lean file and I write theorem square root of 2 is irrational. And then I'm in the middle of writing the proof. And all of a sudden, I notice some things that are suspicious. And it turns out that Lean has various different versions of the square root function. One is in the namespace, it's sort of rational dot square root. And what it is it's kind of like some sort of rational approximation to the square root of function. And that's the one that I had used in the statement. So the theorem, as I had stated it, square root of 2 is irrational, was false, because for this version of the irrational function, it was in fact true. So that was a mistake that I made, not an AI. But when complex definitions are involved, you really, 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 really have to check that they mean exactly what you think they do. The other thing is we, meaning the Lean community, has seen a few examples where an AI kind of tries to cheat somehow. So a thing that it could do, for instance, is add an extra axiom, axiom 0 equals 1 to the top of the file, presented in a kind of obscure way, and then it can prove whatever you want, and it'll pass the type checker, because certainly assuming 0 equals 1, whatever you're trying to prove is true. sort of other kind of behaviors like that.
It could exploit a recently discovered inconsistency in the proof system, right? I mean,
right, exactly. Yeah, there's always the possibility of bugs in the kernel. So anyway, what I would certainly go on the record of saying is that a auto-formalized proof is more reliable than a natural language proof. I guess maybe depending on the subject area, there's some areas where the mathematics library just is nowhere near the statement, and so there's no chance that the statement is correct, in which case the auto-formalization is sort of a fantasy from the start. But within a domain that is covered by a human-engineered mathematics library, I would say an auto-formalized proof is more reliable than a natural language proof. But there's still a role for human referees.
Actually, I wonder a bit, because we talked about lots of convenience, that synthetic mathematics more convenient, but if you have just throw enough AI on it, then maybe this problem sort of disappears, because the AI is just happy to prove everything with quasi-categories, which humans would not be able to manage, right?
I strongly disagree with that. I mean, there's definitely a role for AI in formalization, which is to make it easier. Sometimes people talk about the de Bruijn index, which is technically like the amount of lines of formal code that correspond to lines of natural language proof. I think a more relevant factor is how much time it takes to write a formal proof versus a natural language proof. And everybody working in the space would prefer it to take less time. And if an AI can help with that, that would be great. But proof quality still matters. I mean, there's no permanent place in the world for ugly mathematics. And similarly, the process of formalizing is not just about checking that a theorem is true, but building a library that is usable as the basis for further formalization efforts. And code quality there matters enormously. And so I don't want a sloppy, unreadable, incredibly long proof of some fact of quasi-categories. I think it's worth the effort of figuring out a way to do this in a way that's actually understandable to humans and can be used as the basis for getting to the frontiers of mathematics, research frontiers of mathematics.
I wholeheartedly agree with this, but there was a discussion in computer science, right? So we suggest sort of high-level programming languages which support abstraction and so on, which is similar to what you describe in mathematics. We like to write programs, nice programs, yeah? But actually now with AI, you can generate these programs. And then the question is, do you actually need these high-level languages? Because the AI can also produce a similar code, which is maybe not as readable, but in the end what matters is that it runs. I mean, but maybe that's different in mathematics.
I guess I'd be surprised if computer scientists are willing to abandon everything but Python because of the existence of AI. And I think mathematicians similarly, won't accept a future where the only formal language system is lean. So,
sure. I mean, I agree, but I mean, there is this tension. I mean, this possibility that all this sort of high level stuff actually doesn't really matter so much anymore because the AI bridges the gap. I mean, it's not a future I would like, but it's a possibility.
Just the tiny remark that we had similar discussions when computer usage in general entered mathematics, right? The four-color theorem was celebrated but also hated because some mathematicians said, we just have this huge case distinction, but this lovely, beautiful problem is dead now and the high-class mathematician won't touch it. And maybe they would have found out new techniques or deeper understanding or whatever. But then later, even though it was proven, still the best graph theorists try to reprove it, shorten the amount of cases needed, and things like that.
No, I had a bit more personal question, which it's a question of you as a woman. I mean, I think in mathematics it's still gender imbalance and can you comment on this? And do you think it's something you should overcome, or is this an issue? And if so, how?
Yeah, I guess I will say I still think it is harder in some ways for a woman who is entered mathematics to kind of find, interested in mathematics to find her way into the community than it is for some other folks. You know, I know a lot of young women who, you know, feel that extra pressure whenever they want to ask a question in class, for instance, that, you know, the sort of quality of the question or the fact that the question reveals that they haven't already understood something will then reflect negatively on, you know, their entire gender. I think that's still a very, very real experience. And you could imagine sort of two parallel students, one of which feels like they can ask questions with abandon and one of which can never ask questions at all. And, you know, who's going to be in a better position a few years down the road? Not so much within the math research community, but at lower levels, I also hear a lot of stories of students who are sort of explicitly discouraged from, you know, going into mathematics, you know, by a teacher in a high school or, you know, somebody trying to push them, you know, to take easier courses or to say, you know, this isn't really for you. I mean, it's shocking that that still happens, but that does still happen. You know, I think at the kind of more advanced levels, what that means in a sense that the sort of women who make it are kind of tougher in some sense, have maybe spent more time thinking about, like, do I really want to be a mathematician? Is this the career that I'm looking for? And then, you know, tend to have the persistence and to kind of carry it through because they've already sort of had, you know, thought critically about whether there's maybe some other use of their time. So, yeah, I think we should still be mindful, you know, not just along the gender axis, but along other axes about how kind of different experiences might affect our students and who's encouraged to continue. I certainly have a lot more fun at conferences where there are more women. Just sort of socially, I think it makes a difference. I feel less pressure when I'm asking a question in a conference if there's a lot of other women in the conference asking questions too. And you know, but we're trending in the right direction. And I think as long as people are still kind of mindful that not everybody gets to the classroom and with the same experiences, I think things will continue to improve. So.
Lovely educational comment or comment on education or however to phrase it. May I ask you, is there anything else you would love to speak about that we missed where we're too narrow on in a math or...
I guess maybe I have a question for you. I mean, there's something that I'm curious about, which seems to be kind of a, I don't know how to describe this, but a sort of like historical or sort of practical or circumstantial split between the like type theory community and the kind of set theory logic community. I don't know if this is part of your experience, if you have any explanation for it. I'm very curious about how this came about, or if I'm accurate in describing it that way. And I guess I mean maybe within mathematics as opposed to within computer science.
I think that's a great question. I have my own account, but I'm not sure whether it's historically accurate. So shall I start, Thorsten?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so I guess I come from the set theory side of things. And I would say two things. Whenever some mindset or some tradition is kind of dominant, they might not look at the others or the next tradition with the full respect that they should. I mean, I think that's generally true. It's not really only on set theorists, but it's like, okay, there's this weird category stuff, but I don't really care. I can do everything in principle. And I mean, rightly so, I guess. In some sense, you can always reinterpret and emulate things. And of course, on your high level, you see where this emulation misses a tiny spot or isn't fully accurate. But in some sense, you do that. And then there was not as much communication which would have been good. And then we have contingent factors like one mailing list, whichever, was just set theory dominant and category comments get discouraged and then people start their own forums, own communities, and then we have a lot of more division than necessary, so to speak. And the other thing is maybe that category theory had more interest and desire physics things than set theory, because historically back then we just needed the foundation to prove a point, but we never really used the foundation, right?
Uh-huh.
We didn't touch it. But that's only my historically inaccurate account. So, Thorsten, what do you think?
Yeah, can I have add more? I think you asked about community, but I would like to add a personal perspective. Actually, I gave a talk a few years ago at Lambda Days in Krakow, and I started it with a programming language, a CV, and I tracked down what programming languages I have been using. And I started with a language called BASIC, and I earned some money doing assembly programming. And then I was not satisfied with the sort of, with these languages and looked for better ones. And I ended up with sort of like functional languages, like I had Lisp programming, and then I typed functional languages and so on. And this is, I guess that's my interest. So I always, I'm sort of looking for the perfect way to express yourself. Yeah. And this experience is that in mathematics, it seemed to me that the people are quite stuck with a foundational system which has been developed in like almost 100 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And don't question whether this is a really good way to express yourself. And for me, this is quite important to choose a good language to express yourself. And I mean, this really, for me, the analogy is when I was doing assembly programming and I learned C, and I tried to tell people you shouldn't really use C and not assembly programming. I said, but we can do everything which you need to do, we can do in assembly. Why would we learn a high-level language like C, which was more high-level than assembly? Yeah? And this, in a way, reminds me on the same, just, or not the same, but analogous justification. Yeah, we can do everything in first-order logic and set theory, so why would we learn anything else?
Uh-huh.
And I think that language and leverage of language is quite essential to make progress. So,
yeah, I guess my personal perspective is, you know, with AI, there's going to be an increasing emphasis within mathematics on computer formalization. And with computer formalization, there's going to be an increasing importance and emphasis in mathematics on foundations and expertise in foundations, but explicitly including type theory, because that seems to sort of predominate amongst the formal systems used by computer proof assistants. So mm-hmm. I would love to see more expertise on foundations within mathematics departments in general and sort of type theory in particular, you know, not because I see a future where we have, you know, one foundation for all of mathematics, maybe with type theory replacing set theory, but instead kind of multiple approaches to foundations that, you know, mathematicians can experiment with, maybe with the aid of a computer proof assistant, you know, maybe by developing domain-specific languages to shorten and simplify formal proofs in their particular domain. And, you know, we're going to, you know, if you're implicitly using a foundation system to prove a theorem on paper, then, you know, maybe it's okay that you don't understand it that, you know, to a certain level of depth. But I think we're going to need more sort of real expertise. And so I'd love ideas for how to, you know, kind of bring type theory back into the fold and also, you know, reinforce sort of other approaches to foundations at the same time. But yeah.
Yeah, I think pluralism is a theme that comes up often in our podcast, which might be a tiny empirical evidence that you are right in that direction. Great. So I'm really happy about this talk. I learned a lot. Sorry if I slowed down the discussion.
It was that was a useful intervention. So thanks for that. So
okay. Yeah. So if there is no urgent thing to say, I would say
thanks very much. Yeah.
So. Thank you for being here, and have a great week.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye bye.